Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. After a rally earlier in the week, Wall Street ended sharply down on Friday. Ross tells us why. He also tells us the U.S. dollar remains a major factor worldwide. Publisher of the realestatetiming.com newsletter, Robert Campbell, gives us his view on real estate, the markets, commodities, and gold, and comments on why staying fit might also make you a better investor. Do the sun and planets control our financial destinies? Ray Merriman from Merriman Market Analyst tells us about financial astrology and how accurate it's been over the past 40 years. He has some interesting takes on the upcoming U.S. midterm elections and the Russian-Ukraine conflict. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
Well, after a two-day rally on Wall Street, at the end of the week, not the same story. What happened there?
No. Things kind of rolled over the middle of the week, and then the number that everybody was waiting for, the employment number, came out. So what you got is very strong employment numbers on the U.S., 3.5% unemployment, very strong number, the type of thing you haven't seen in decades. Canadian number also pretty darn good here. So when the economy is that strong, it means that the Fed is going to stay the course with keeping rates high and probably putting them higher. And the open market, as we trade in the bonds and in the notes, it bottomed out. Those rates bottomed out early in the week and rallied back towards the end of the week. We've got interest rates now back, 3.8% on the 10-year, 3.84 on the 30-year on bonds. So those trends definitely still in motion. They had a decent pullback, but the underlying trend is really quite dominant in here. Yeah, with this strong U.S. dollar, and that meant flight to cash for a lot of people. Dollar index had pulled back to 110 the early part of the week when the equity markets enjoyed that rally. The dollar index closing at 112.75. So we've been thinking that it might correct a little bit deeper on the correction, but that the uptrend would stay in motion. At this point, there's no question about that. And, you trade the trends as they are available to you.
Now, I've seen some people predicting the Canadian dollar will fall to 70 cents U.S. Would you agree with that, that the U.S. dollar is just going to remain totally hot?
Yeah, well, the dollar, I mean, this is all part of the post-bubble contraction that Bob and I talked about, and we've got longer-term targets that are up in the 120 range as far as the dollar index is concerned. So if you think about that and the relationship with the Canadian dollar, the Canadian dollar under 70 is entirely possible. We're at 72.75 this at the end of the week. And, this is with just an exceptional move in the crude oil price. Crude on the week is up 16%, we're at 92, just over 92.50 to close off the week. And this is up from 76 and a quarter just a couple of weeks ago. So, you can thank the OPEC Plus for being an instigator there to get things going. But in reality, the oil market was at a good support level there at 76, good targeted support, and the turn was appropriate. The stocks, if you take a look at the ETFs, the XLE and the XCG, the oil and gas stocks, nice double bottoms here over the last couple of months, and just starting to break out through the upper part of that trading range as far as those double bottoms are concerned. So that's the one area where there was some green on the page, and as we finished off the week. And looking at the oil, we've got a series of resistance levels that we can be looking at. The first ones are just here, maybe at about $1, $1.50 above this level. But if we have the larger corrective rally, which I think is entirely possible, you could be looking at either 97 or 103 as the major resistance level. So that would be correcting up to maybe 50% of the drop from the $130 high. So yeah, we kind of keep an eye on that one.
What's happening with gold?
The precious metals, we ended up with gold rallying back to its 28-day, 50-day moving averages on its last rally. That was a pretty good first target for the move. Pretty mediocre finish to the week as the dollar showed its strength. And, you have... But we've been, down from 1630 on gold, rallied 1740, and now closing at 1703. So it's pulled back about a third of the rally off the bottom. Wouldn't be at all surprised to see it trade down into the 1670 range. Silver had been a really important one here in terms of the commitment of traders numbers. We had the commercials, net long on their positions back in early September when the silver market was down around 17.5. And it's very rare that you see the commercials net long. Well, as of this week, we've seen those positions start to turn. The commercials now about a 11,000 contract change in their positions. And in gold, about a 34,000 contract move. So you've probably got now too many of the speculators long in the precious metals and ready for a bit of a correction here. But the silver market, I think, still has some upside to go. The gold market probably going to be a little harder in terms of staging a rally. And if the equity markets continue to stay under pressure, the miners are probably going to have continued difficulty on the upside. So I think you just have to have some patience here on the precious metals stocks and these miners in terms of buying the hard dips and look at them as maybe a long-term trade rather than a short-term trade.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you, Jim.
And have a great Canadian Thanksgiving.
Looking forward to it.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on Twitter at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Robert Campbell, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, author of Timing the Real Estate Market and the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter. You can find him online at realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from San Diego. Bob, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you very much.
When can we look forward to the next issue of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter?
That will be in, I just published one September 15th. So that was like, 2.5 weeks ago. So the next one will be November 15th. So I publish it every 2 months.
How can people sign up for it?
They can go to my website at realestatetiming.com, just like it sounds, and, you can read what I do.
How did your September speaking engagement go?
Oh, went really well. You know what? I've given so many speeches in the last 21 years and seminars, but for some reason, this one went better than ever because the title of the seminar was How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love Inflation. And I went over the economics of inflation, you know, and what causes it and what it does to you. And what and specifically as an investor, you know, what asset classes you can be in, you should be in, and which ones you should be out of, and, you know, and the best defense against inflation is to be skilled at something so you maintain your standard of living. But interestingly, I had about 35 people there. It was at the La Jolla Marriott. And afterwards, I would say 20% of the people came up to me and said, Bob, that was excellent. When is your next seminar? And I've never had that happen before, Jim. So I put this together, and I'll tell you, explaining economics, explaining inflation, I took about 2 weeks of preparing for this and trying to dumb it down so people can understand it, and everybody understood it. You know, that if you can't explain something so somebody else doesn't understand it, you don't know what you're talking about. And so I got it down there, and I went, I get that. Because you start talking like that, a crazy economics professor and something like that, and start talking about these wild equations and these theories and stuff like this. You know, I can't even stand listening to it, because I know most of us just BS. But you get down to the brass tacks of it, and also you study charts and say, okay, look at this. The basis of what I do is study charts. I look at charts, you know, over a long period of time and say, that what happened then, you know, look what happened then. Look what, that same thing happened then. The same thing happened then. You know, how could you have been alerted to these events, financial events in advance so that you could, you know, profit for them or avoid losing money from them? And so I looked back at the inflationary period of different countries and in the United States from 66 through 81 and what asset classes performed best and other periods of time too. And so what the conclusions I came up with, the two best asset classes to own during inflationary times are commodities and gold. They just outperform everything, you know, by a large degree. So I told them, buy commodities, buy gold. You know, that's where my investment portfolio is right now. That's non-real estate. So I just have it in that. And it's just interesting. People could understand it. They can see it if you show them. You go, look at this different episodes here. And they show how different asset classes perform, you know, during these periods of time. The last thing you want to own is bonds, of course, because those just get killed. And, you know, the interest rates go up and all that stuff. And so people really, really understood it. But they went, wow, this is good. How about another? So when's your next seminar? And I didn't have another seminar planned. You know, it takes a lot of work to put on one of those seminars. But so I know the response was better than I've ever had. I've had much bigger crowds, but never had that kind of, you know, sometimes it's nice having a smaller crowd because I know most of these people that are my followers. I know them by their first names, and you can look at them, you can call them out, and you can let people talk. You can let people talk when there's 35. When there's 100, you can't let people talk. It just gets out of control. So it was very enjoyable, and everybody loved it, which is, you know, that's the bottom line. Everybody got their money's worth and more, and they were satisfied. They said, when's the next seminar? I want to sign up.
Does your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, cover times like this?
No, it doesn't. It really does. It covers all times. It covers non-inflation, inflation, you know, recessions, boom times. because those are the indicators that call, you know, that call the peaks and valleys of the leading indicators that call the peaks and valleys of the housing market. And so, you know, they could be during any of those times. And interestingly, when you look about how did real estate perform during the inflationary environment, real estate didn't do too badly. It kind of held its own. You know, in the United States, it didn't do that well in California, but it held its own in other parts of the United States. It didn't win or it didn't lose, you know, as opposed to like owning bonds or owning stocks that just got smashed. But interesting, when I told people about commodities and gold, I said, okay, if you hang on to your real estate, yeah, you know, if everything goes the way it has in the past, you'll probably end up no better or no worse, which isn't bad. But if you put your money in commodities and gold based on the performance of the past, you could double or triple your money in the next five years. So it's all about, you know, that putting your money where it's treated best, likely to be treated best.
What are your thoughts on the stock markets?
I think the stock market's going down. And I don't time the stock market. I'm a trend follower in the stock market. And because the stock market is really difficult to time. Real estate's much, much easier. That's why I've made, you know, by far the vast majority of my money, all my money in real estate, because I know it best. But the stock, here's where the stock market's going to get killed. Inflation right now is at 8%, official government number. All these businesses, these big corporations in the United States, they all have debt. They never pay the debt off. All they do is roll it over when it becomes due, just like the U.S. government. So let's say you owe $10 million, for example, and it's got a five-year duration, average duration, so every year 20% of that debt becomes due. Okay, last year when you rolled it over at 3%. Well, this year when the 20% becomes due, you got to refinance it and issue new debt, and you're going to roll it over at not 3%, but 6%. That's double. So that cost right there of debt financing is going to hurt earnings dramatically. Then, not only is it hurt from that, but when you get in inflationary times, the cost of doing business just starts increasing. About a month ago, FedEx, it fell over 20% in one day. And all of a sudden they said, oh yeah, the outlook, you know, the forecast was for earnings to remain level. You go, okay, then how come the stock dropped 22%? Because earnings are collapsing. Because not only is debt financing, the cost of doing business with debt increasing, but that, you know, for them to run those airplanes and run their operation, the cost of, the inflationary effect that, you know, they're paying 8% more for things than they were a year ago. So earnings are going to get hit real bad. Real bad. And that's what happens during inflation. It's the cost of doing business. And if you can't pass those costs onto the consumer, you know, you have to eat it. And that's what FedEx did. And its stock dropped, 22% in one day. I mean, that's a blue chip stock. And I think the same thing kind of happened to Nike. So that's what's going to happen to all corporations. Their earnings are going to get hit. And fundamentally, even though I'm not a fundamentalist, what drives stock market prices is earnings. You know, long-term earnings. The more you earn, the more the stock's worth. You know, kind of that thing. So earnings are going to get hit real bad. So I don't like the stock market. I like commodities. I like gold.
The Fed's the big story. What do you think the Fed will do next and then going forward?
Well, I think the Fed has no choice. I know there's a lot of debate about this. Everybody expects the Fed to pivot. You know, it's already bad. The stock market's down 25%. People are hurting and all that. But what people are hurting more, if you listen to what the Fed's saying, that Chairman Jay Powell is saying, he said, the average American is getting hurt real bad. His earnings aren't nearly keeping up with inflation. And so we have to protect that guy. And you know what? He does have to protect that guy. Because you know who owns stocks? Rich guys. Do you think they could take a pounding and still be okay? Yeah. Do you think Joe Sixpack can have his utility bill go up 30 to 40% in a year and still be okay? No. He's screwed. Food goes up 20%. He's screwed. So you gotta protect that guy. You can't protect the asset holders. and go, well, we got to keep stocks high because, you know, at high levels because people will get hurt. Rich people own stocks. Screw the rich people. They've made enough money from this. I mean, and the, you know, on this kind of stuff. And they did it on the back of the Fed. So I think the Fed, they got two bad choices. You know, should we raise interest rates and kill the markets and kill the economy? Or should we let inflation run wild and let the asset markets do what they're going to do? And kill the middle income person where inflation gets to, you know, 12%, 15%, where he can't even make a living. And I think he really has no choice. He has to save people because they'll be destitute. That's a fact. They'll be destitute. And so they're going to have to raise interest rates, keep raising interest rates up to the point, where finally it breaks inflation. And that's going to take a while. People think, oh yeah, inflation is going to be back down to 2% here in the United States in a year. No, it's not. Look at history. History shows that after most countries, and they've done studies on it, were like 30 or 40 countries that had inflation above like 7 or 8%, you know, developed countries. And they said, how long does it take to get back down to 2%? You know what the average was? 6 to 7 years. That's the average. So people think that, oh yeah, we're going to be back and running to normal. Interest rates are going to be, you know, at mortgage rates are going to be 3% and inflation is going to be 2% in a year. That ain't going to happen. That would be a miracle, economic miracle if that happens. So it's going to be and if you look at past inflations, that's what happens. It's a slow grind, down. And so we're going to have to deal with this problem for a long time. In fact, what I've just, that the higher interest rates go, that the U.S. dollar, the king dollar, is just roaring in the markets. And it's just bankrupting people. In fact, just a few days ago, I adjusted my portfolio. I sold half of my commodity position and bought the U.S. dollar. I think the U.S. dollar is going to the moon. And the reason it's going to the moon, everybody, is this. The euro's in the tank. The British pound's in the tank. Their economies are in the tank. You know, I think the euro, that they raised interest rates to 1% and inflation is 9%. That's not going to work. Same thing in Britain. So they have no choice but to raise interest rates, and everybody, and their currencies are collapsing against the dollar. And the reason they're doing that is the U.S. dollar's the prettiest of the ugly sisters. And so everybody's selling euros to buy U.S. dollars. I mean, because what would you rather do? Would you rather buy like a 2-year note in euros that yields 1% with inflation at 9%? Or would you rather buy, you know, a 2-year note in the United States at like 3% or 4% when inflation is lower? I mean, even lower than that. The dollar's the better place to have your money. And so that you gotta trade euros to buy dollars, to buy a better yield. And so you have a real capital flight into the U.S. dollar right now because all these other currencies are in bad shape. They're so shitty. Everybody wants out. And so the dollar could roar. It could roar. So anyway, I mean, I'm just telling you, I put half my money in there. And I think about this stuff before I do it. This isn't a trade. This is what I hope is a long-term investment. I'm going to say long-term investment. I mean, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. I could see, you know. In fact, when you look at what happened during the early 1980s in the United States, the U.S. dollar index, I think, hit a level of 160. Right now it's 100, it's 110. So if it's going back, if inflation's going back up to those levels, and they're going to have to raise interest rates up to those levels, money's going to keep flowing into the U.S. economy. They got to buy dollars. The dollar's just going to get stronger and stronger. And if you look at that trend, you know, knowing that the trend's your friend, the trend is clearly up, just up, you know. So I know it's kind of like jumping on board a moving freight train at this point in time. But still, I made the decision to do it because I think it's a good bet. I think it's a high percentage bet.
How high is the national debt in the U.S. and how could rising interest rates affect it?
You know, the U.S. debt, I believe it just hit $31 trillion. And what the problem for the U.S. government is the same problem that that U.S. corporations are facing. I think the average duration of the government debt is 5 years. That means every year 20% of the debt comes due. Well, the average interest rate paid on the government debt right now, I'm sure, let's just call it 3%. It's low. So now they got to roll that over. It becomes due. They have to issue new bonds. And you don't issue new bonds at 3%. You're going to have to issue new bonds at 5%. That's a big difference. So all of a sudden, now the cost of financing, of debt servicing for the United States just keeps rising and rising and rising with interest rates. And pretty soon, I think right now, that I understand where interest rates are at, servicing the national debt is close to $1 trillion a year. When interest rates were low $2, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was about $300 or $400 billion. That's a big increase. So that's where you get screwed, guys. You get screwed, you live above your means, whether it's a government or yourself. You live above your means, and you can do that because debt is cheap. Interest rate, zero interest rate policy, it doesn't cost you hardly anything to finance whatever your wishes are. Then that changes. The house you bought, the car you bought, whatever else you financed. It was marked to the market based on housing here in the United States, based on 2.5-3% mortgage rate. Okay, that's good. That's good if you stay in your house for the rest of your life. However, if something changes during the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and you have to sell your house for some reason, and most people only own their house for 7 years, you know, there's a death, a divorce, you lose your job, you get a job relocation, you paid $1 million for that house on $100,000 interest because you could finance it at 2.5% mortgage rate. Yep, that works. Okay. Yeah, because the debt's so cheap. Now, all of a sudden, mortgage rates here in the States, let's just call it 7%. So it's almost three times higher. For whatever reason, you have to sell that house. And there's a lot of reasons why. So that $1 million house is being sold. The same guy's not making any more money than he was because the economy's in the tank. He's making $100,000. But interest rates are at 7%. He can't afford a $950,000 mortgage on a $100,000 salary like you could. He can afford a $650,000 mortgage. So you just lost 30% of the value of your house just based on the movement of interest rates. And it's that simple. Nobody's going to lend to you. And so if you have to sell your house, you're going to take a big, big hit. And once a house takes a hit like that, let's say everybody on your block has a house like, I live in California, so I throw $1 million around like it's nothing, because in California, throwing $1 million around for houses is nothing. That's the average price house. So let's say every house on the block's worth $1 million, and your neighbor loses his job. He bought his $1 million house with a 2.5% interest rate, or refinanced it 2.5%. Now he lost his job. His wife lost his job. He got a job transfer. Somebody died. It was a medical emergency. Whatever. Now he's got to sell his house, and the current interest rate is 7%. He just lost 30% of it. All of a sudden, that house didn't sell for $1 million on the block. Now it's sold for $700,000. Guess what the new value of homes is on my block, Jim? $700,000. That's the market. That's the market, you know, because prices are always set at the margin, and that's the margin. Now everybody looks and goes, holy crap, I bought my house for $1 million, and Joe just sold the same house for $700,000. I'm screwed. A lot of people might go, I need to get out of this thing. Most people that bought recently, however, that 30% decrease, you know, now they're close to break even. Now they're close to like where the mortgage is equal to the value of their house. So let's say interest rates go a little higher and rates fall and the value of their house falls a little more. Pretty soon you could be at the point your house is worth $700,000 and you owe $700,000. Now you're screwed. Now you're just screwed, you know, because you know what that does to you? It stresses you out too, Jim. When all of a sudden you get that deep in debt and you got inflation going off at 8% or double digits, whatever it's going to. And that's why inflation is so nasty. And that's why you really, really have to be on the ball to stay ahead of inflation. I mean, and all I'm trying to do is if I can just preserve the purchasing power of my money through this inflation, not even make a profit, but not lose money due to inflation, I'll consider that to be a major victory.
What could happen if the Fed reduced the bank rate?
Well, what they could do is this. It would start reflating everything. All of a sudden, they reduce the bank rate. You know, it would juice housing again. Everybody would start borrowing money, in, you know, borrowing more money, increased demand, and interest rates would go down, and it would juice the economy. It would stimulate the economy at a time when inflation is roaring. That's the last thing you want to do. The thing, because that's like pouring gasoline on a burning fire. You got to reduce demand to get inflation down, not increase it.
Are there ways to deflate debt bubbles instead of having them burst?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I don't like to be too negative because, you know, I've been through these cycles before and people tend to be like, this is it, and this is never it. But it does come to the point where you just have so much debt, and that $31 trillion of debt was financed with a 40-year downtrend in interest rates. That's how we were able to accumulate that much debt. Just like the homeowner was able to purchase a $1 million home, not because his income went up, but because the cost of a mortgage went down to rock bottom levels, and he could afford a $900,000 mortgage at 2.5%. How much mortgage can he afford at 7%? Not 900,000, it's probably 650. So the market's going to get priced, you know, priced according to what interest rates are. Interest rates are the most important financial ingredient in the where the markets go. And we had 40 years down from 1981 through 2022, and now all of a sudden inflation is back in force, and all of a sudden, you know, rates have ticked up tremendously. Mortgage rates in the States have gone from 2.5 to 7. That's a big increase. And what it's going to do is just going to wallop the housing market. And I tell people this about housing. You know, even if you hold your own, I've seen some forecasts come out, and I don't listen to forecasts. I just see them when I'm on econ blogs, the good ones that I go to. And I said, okay, let's say Goldman Sachs just came out and they said they expect U.S. housing prices to fall like maybe 10% during the correction. Nominally, 10%. Okay. Does that mean you're going to, that in an inflationary environment, does that mean you're going to lose 10%, only 10% on your house? No. Like, let's say we add 8% inflation. We average 8% inflation for the next 5 years, which is very possible. 8 times 5 is 40. Add that down to 10. You just lost 50% of the value of your home on an inflation adjusted basis. And why adjust for inflation? Because that's what your money's worth. It's what your money's worth. All of a sudden, I sold my $1 million house for $1 million. $1 million. So I got all my money back. Yeah, what is that? Does that buy you the same amount that it did when you bought your home? No, it buys me 50% less. And so you're lost. I've studied the markets for so long, and I've seen some of the best traders in the world, investors in the world, when they decide to retire, Jim, you know what they say? They want to know what to do with their money. So they give it to three different money managers that they trust. One's short-term, one's medium-term, and one's long-term. And you know what they hope for? They said, with changing market conditions, with inflation, and with taxation, my goal is just to maintain the purchasing power of the $20 million I made for the rest of my life. I don't care if I make a profit. Just give me my money back in purchasing power. That's hard to do. That's really hard to do.
Past due notices are increasing on all kinds of credit cards. Is this a warning sign for the economy?
Yeah, it is. Sure. I'm sure, I'm not a credit card guy, but I'm sure rates are back up to high levels again. You know, they'll screw you any way they can, those credit card companies. But also this, here's something else. Mortgage, everybody's got so much equity in their house. Mortgage equity withdrawals, where they borrow money and get cash out mortgage refis against their house to use the money for something else. Those have become more and more popular in the last year or 2 years. You know what the banks, that all of a sudden we start getting into the housing market downturn with bad economic conditions? Somebody comes in with their house, unless it's just like super low loan to value, say, I want to do a cash out refi. You know what the answer is going to be? No. No. Because they've gotten in trouble with those before. They don't want to give people cash to get out of their house. They know that can be a real problem. So those are going to get shut down or dramatically reduced. So people are not going to have the access to that equity if they need the money.
Should the focus be on the U.S. dollar?
Yep, it should be on the U.S. dollar, and that's where it is. Like I said, we're the prettiest of the ugly sisters, and plus we're the world reserve currency, and everybody's thinking like, okay, is is the Fed going to let inflation, you know, go to 15% and see the U.S. dollar collapse? And the U.S. dollar collapses? No, probably not. So they just got to, they literally have to pick their poison here. Who are they going to save? They're going to save the stock market and all the rich people that own stocks? I mean, you know, something like 90% of the stock market is owned by the 10% of the wealthiest people in the United States. Joe Sixpack doesn't own stocks. So are they going to save those guys? Those guys don't need saving. Yeah, so their net worth falls from, $20 million to $10 million. Big deal. They're not going to be out on the street eating out of garbage cans. But, you know, the average guy out here whose, you know, utility bill has just gone up 30% in 1 year, and food bill's gone up 20% in 1 year, and gasoline's gone up 20% in 1 year, he just can't up, and those things you cannot do without. Those are life necessities. That guy's screwed. That guy's just, and you know what? I think the Fed knows it. The Fed knows it. And if they just let inflation run wild, you could have food riots, and we could have an Argentina situation here, right? So they can't let it happen. They have to stop inflation, and if they don't, oh my God, Katie bar the door. There's going to be social unrest. Talk about homelessness.
Are there safe places for wealth?
Yeah, well, that's what I think. The safe places for wealth right now are commodities and gold and the U.S. dollar. You got to move your. My attitude about investing is this: adjust, adjust, adjust. And I got that from Charles Darwin. It's the species that survive are not the smartest, they're not the strongest, but they're the ones that are most adaptable to change. And that's it. And that's what people do. You just have to adjust. And I know people don't like that change hitting them, you know, right between the eyes. But that's the only way you're going to survive, guys. If you don't adjust with the times, you're just going to be roadkill. And I say roadkill. I mean, I know there's a lot of listeners here that are probably, you know, wealthy. But the average person in the United States, let's say, the United States is considering I don't know how it compares to Canada. But, you know, everybody says that the people in the United States are the wealthiest in the world. You know what the average net worth is of the average American over 65 years old? $250,000. Is that wealthy? No, it's not. In this environment, it's not at all. So everybody thinks everybody's got this money. The only people that really have money are the super rich. The people in the top 10%, they do okay. They hold their own. In the top 5%, they do really well. In the 1%, you know, those are the criminals that are in on everything. They get bailed out when everything goes wrong. But unless you're in the top 10%, your standard of living keeps going down, down, down through both boom and bust periods because you don't adjust to the times. And the average American, something like, you know, 60, 70% of his net worth is in his house. So your house, you can't get any money out of that. That is an asset that doesn't pay you any return whatsoever. So all of a sudden, you need other assets, you know. You need real estate or you need stocks that are going up. You need something that keeps going up in value in order to maintain your standard of living. And so, but a house doesn't do that. A house is just a place to live. Does it matter to you financially whether your house is worth $500,000 or $1 million? No. Does that change your standard of living? No. Not one bit. The only way you're going to cash in on that is if you sell your $1 million house in California and move to Arizona and replace the same house for $350,000. And people are doing that. And are they doing that because they'd rather live in Arizona instead of the beach in California? No. Some are because of the politics here, the far left rhetoric that comes out of the politicians. But most of the people are doing that for financial reasons. And nobody knows that better than me because I have subscribers all over the United States and I know a lot of them personally, and especially the ones in California, and I know a ton of people that have left California and moved to Texas and moved to Arizona. And all of a sudden, they replaced their home for one-third the value and now they have $600,000 cash left to try to survive through retirement. They're doing that. So, you know, that's what it's coming down to. You know, getting by nowadays, especially during this inflation, is going to get harder and harder and harder. And the only way you can cash in on your house is you got to leave California. You got to sell it and leave California. And if you really want to kick ass, sell in California and move to Alabama or Mississippi. You can replace the same house for like $200,000. I mean, because those states are the poorest, the property values are the lowest. So you see that happening. I'm never leaving the beach, guys. Look, you know what? I don't have to do that. You know, I'm old enough that I've saved enough money. I've never been an extravagant person. I've always saved 15% of every dollar that I made. I know how to invest, so I'm comfortable financially. I'm not leaving the beach. And that even though I'm not super wealthy by any means, that most of the people that say that are super wealthy, because living at the beach here in California is expensive. Really expensive. But I'm just lucky enough that, you know, I don't have to live at the beach. I live a mile and a half away from the beach. I'm not on the beach. Otherwise, my house would be worth 50 times more, which I don't care. But I'm just saying that, that after you get older and you get comfortable, you know, you don't have a mortgage payment. All of a sudden, you've got assets. And the best way to take care of inflation is be good at something, you guys. That I've been publishing my investment newsletter for 21 years. And people say, why don't you retire? Two things. One, I love it. I love what I do. And two, this is my source of continuing income. I'm not worried about anything. After you've been in business for as long as I have, my income is steady coming in. So you use that and all the savings that you've had. You had Social Security. And guess what? Now you're 75, but you're comfortable financially. I don't have to leave California. So I can stay here. You know, I mean, I don't need to cash in everything and have an extra, you know, $1 million in my account to live. I don't need that. So, and I like to tell everybody, the best way to survive in inflation is to be really good at what you do. Because people keep giving you money. If you're shitty at what you do, you're going to be a casualty. But if you're good at what you do, whether it's you write a good newsletter, you're a good electrician, you're a good home builder or something like that. I mean, really good. Those things aren't, you know, those professions aren't going away. You'll be the first one they call. You'll always have a job, and that's key. So be good at what you do. That's your biggest insurance policy that you can have. Be good at what you do. So your business generates, or your profession generates the cash flow from you that can't be taken away. Because if you're a crappy carpenter and don't give a shit, and all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden you don't care about, you know, developing your skills, you're just a run-of-the-mill carpenter, and times get tough, you're going to get canned. But if you're really good at what you do, a really good carpenter, skilled, you'll always have a job because you're good. So that's the secret, guys. Be good at what you do. And I'm not sure you can do that working for a corporation. Like Nassim Taleb says, the three worst addictions in the world, what was it? They're heroin, carbohydrates, and a job that pays you a salary. Because you're vulnerable there, too. They can can you. And all of a sudden, now what do you do? Let's say you've been canned by a major corporation. What are you going to do? You know, so to me, I'm always the kind of person, my dad was always self-employed. He was a home builder for 55 years here in Southern California. I've always been self-employed, and because it's kind of the people that are self-employed that are accountable for what they do. Nobody's going to roll me out of bed in the morning, a self-employed person. You got to get out of the bed, and the only paycheck that's coming to you is because of your skills. And if you're a crappy plumbing contractor, you're going to go broke. But if you're a good plumbing contractor, you're going to do well. And when times get real tough, you may not do well, but you'll survive. And the key during down markets is surviving, everybody.
What is the stated rate of inflation, and what is likely the real rate of inflation?
Well, here in the United States, I think the August number was 8.3%, and that's a government number. I think you could realistically, you know, knowing what the government does with their hedonic adjustments and everything, to like, you know, 50% of all items that that make up the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, I would say it's probably 3 to 4 percentage points higher. It's in double digits. My wife was editing my a past timing letter about 3 months ago, and according to the government reports, they said food inflation is up 8.3%. She's Italian, 100% Italian. She cooks every day. She goes to the market every day. She goes, that's total bullshit. She goes, it's at least double that. Talk to somebody that goes to the market every day. To ask them if prices are up 8%. No, they're not. They're way more than that. So it's definitely understated, guys. I think everybody knows that, too. It's just we don't know for sure by how much. But I'd say 3 to 4 percentage points probably get you in the ballpark.
Mortgage rates in the U.S. have gone from around 2.5% to nearly 7%. How long is the time lag for the latest mortgage rates to be reflected in home prices, and what are these new prices likely to look like?
Well, I mean, that can happen almost instantaneously. Let's say, for example, that everybody on my block owns $1 million home, and they all bought the $1 million home with a 2.5% mortgage. Something happens to one of them. They have to sell for all the reasons I've previously described. Now they have to sell into a mortgage market where the new buyer has to pay 7%. He's not going to pay $1 million. He's going to pay $700,000 or $650,000. And all of a sudden, that house on the block, the house right next to you that you paid $1 million for last year just sold for $700,000. That's the new price, guys. You can't go, oh, I don't have to sell my house, you may not have to sell your house, but you've just lost 30% of your equity. It just hasn't been realized for tax accounting purposes yet. But you just lost 30% of your money. So it can happen fast.
What percentage of people own their homes free and clear?
In the United States, I think it's about a third. But that even then, let's say a third of all homeowners own their property free and clear. And most of those people are older. They're baby boomers. They're people like me. Now, these people, are closer to the grave than anybody. So as these people die off, and the kids get the house, mom and dad's house, and they go, well, mom and dad's house, it was worth $1 million, a year ago. Yeah, so let's put it on the market. At 2.5% interest rate, it's worth $1 million. They put it on the market, and it's only worth $700,000. You know what's worth? The house is worth $700,000. That's what it's going to sell for. And so all of a sudden, all these boomers that are dying, and the boomers have all the money. They're the ones, who owns that? Who's a big part of that, the one-third of all homeowners that own their home free and clear? It's baby boomers, older people. They've paid off their mortgages, and now they're just sitting there free and clear, waiting for the angels to come and take them to heaven.
Death rates are increasing significantly above the normal rate. Could this affect home prices?
Yep, absolutely. And we don't know why, but the you're seeing this, and it's these, I don't want to get into vaccinations and unvaccinated, but older people, the death rate has gone up double or triple in the last year. Insurance companies, the insured deaths, are getting in trouble. I think they're going to have to get bailed out because under normal situations that you look at statistics and let's say a life insurance company has 1 million people insured. They can tell you within about 10 people, over time, let's say 100, how many people are going to die in any 1 year. Because you have a big sample size, the statistics going back, and it's fairly easy to forecast. All of a sudden, the death rate doubles or triples. That's money you have to pay out and that you don't have in reserves. I don't know how these guys are going to do it. I think they're going to end up getting, for all I know, that they're getting bailed out right now behind the curtains by the Federal Reserve Board. And you'd never hear about that, Jim. You would never hear about that. Does that stuff happen? Of course it happens. Are they going to advertise it? No. They'll just print money and bail them out. They can't let the insurance companies go. They can't let the banks go. These are all too big to fail, right? Or at least that's the attitude. And so, everybody's going to be in trouble. Because the death rate is way up. People like myself, in the last 3 years, the longevity of a male in the United States has fallen from something like 79 years down to like almost 76. We're the only country in the world with medical technology where the death rate is dropping. You're less likely to, you're going to live less years than more years. And a lot of that has to do, I think, that I know for a lot of people that are dying from drug overdoses. And these are guys, you know, in their 40s and 50s. They're getting addicted to drugs because they're having a hard time, taking care of their family. And all of a sudden they feel bad, so they escape, so they start taking drugs. And this is killing people like crazy. And it's not just kids on drug overdoses. These are guys 40 and 50 years old, you know, older guys. All of a sudden they go, this sucks. I can't even afford to take care of my family anymore. And so they start taking drugs, and then they die. And I'm sure that has something to do with the decrease in longevity. But we're the only country in the world where that's happening.
Russia has decreased life expectancy. I saw a study there saying due to alcoholism.
Okay.
And China has less life expectancy due to poor air quality, although China also has a very high smoking rate. That's the poor air quality. So yep. The U.S. isn't alone in seeing declining life expectancy, but a country like U.S. should not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, with our medical technology and everything, we should be, just compare us, for example, to Japan. I think the average male in Japan lives to be like 85 years old. I could be off a few years. And here in the United States, we're at like 76, 77. What's wrong with that picture, Jim? Something's wrong, right? I mean, is Japan more advanced technology and medical-wise than the U.S.? Or is there a problem with their people? It's a problem with the people. People don't like living anymore. They need escapes, escape mechanisms, drugs. And that's what it is. It's alcohol. It's drugs. People don't start taking, you know, opioids, you know, for drills like you did in college. They take it to escape, and it kills them. It's killing them. That's the way I see it. That's really sad. Really sad. And I have no idea how to fix that problem.
What does it mean when home prices are set at the margin?
What that means is this, and I've kind of explained this so far, that, okay, everybody on my block has a house that's worth $1 million, right? We're all enjoying, yeah, worth $1 million. That's what Joe sold his house, you know, 6 months ago when the new buyer came in at $1 million. We're all worth $1 million, assuming we have the same home. Now, all of a sudden, my next door neighbor runs into a financial problem, loses his job, gets sick, someone dies or whatever, and he has to sell his home. At 7% interest rate. So he's not going to sell it with $1 million. He's going to sell it at 700,000. That's the price, what they call set at the margin. And it's the same in stocks. You know, all of a sudden somebody says, yeah, you see a stock market drop, like in FedEx, you know, a month or so ago when it fell 22%. Let's just say it was selling for $100 a share, as an example, prior to the drop. And now it's selling for, $78. That $78 price, that's set at the margin. That's what FedEx shares are worth right now. $78. They were worth $100 a share the day before, but now they're worth $78 because the last price controls.
Is economics easy?
No, it's really hard. It's really hard. I have a economics degree from UCLA, and I've stayed with it. But the only thing that has value that they teach you in college, and they don't even mention this, is the law of supply and demand. Everything else they teach you, all this stuff is either theory, opinion, or just pure BS. And because it's a social science, it takes a long time to understand it, particularly the fact that there's so many moving parts. When you start having to explain how inflation works and how the dollar moves up and down with interest rates and with inflation, you better really know what you're talking about because you'll confuse yourself. And it took me 30 years to figure it out, Jim. So it's really a difficult subject. And, you know, and so they don't even teach that stuff in school. You have to go out in the real world and learn it on your own.
What do schools teach in economics?
Crap that you'll never use. Crap that you'll never use. I can't even remember the classes I had to. The only class I had to take in my econ class, I think, was I had to take statistics. My best subject was always math, but I would never want to be a mathematician. I don't know what you do as a math major, so teach college, and I'm not going to do that. So, but the statistics, because I tell people that if you don't understand numbers, if you don't understand how to come up with probabilities, you're going to make a decision on something. If you can't use your brain to come up with probabilities whether that decision is going to be a good one or a bad one, you're going to have a real hard time in life. Real hard time. And that's another sad thing. So many kids grow up right now, you know, and they don't know how to do math. They don't know how to do math. How do you get ahead in this world if you can't add or subtract and multiply and divide? I don't see how it's possible. And in fact, you can't, it's super hard to exceed if you don't understand basic mathematics. Because you don't understand probabilities. And anybody that makes decisions on a day-to-day basis, you have to look at it analytically based on probability. What do you think the probability of us succeeding, you know, in our endeavors to do this? And you have to come up with some kind of numbers. Look at history that, oh, so-and-so did this and they did this. But if you have no idea how to come up with probabilities, you're just shooting from the hip all the time. And most of the time it's going to be made on emotional basis, not on analytical basis. And emotional decisions are the very worst.
In investing and in life, is there psychological pressure to follow the herd?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I tell people that, you know, price movement, whether it's stocks, real estate, bonds, or gold, or whatever, baseball cards, Beanie Babies, 50% of it, over 50% of it probably, is all based on psychology, fear and greed. Because when the herd starts, when the herd starts moving in one direction, you move with it. And that's what's so difficult to overcome. You have to succeed in life. Because to succeed in life, you have to buy when prices are low and sell when prices are high. To buy when prices are low, is the herd telling you that's a good idea? No, just the opposite. You're going to get your head handed to you. And when prices are high, I mean, what's the herd telling you? Oh, they're going to the moon. Yeah, this is going to go on for another year or two. And so you have to know to be able to break away from the herd to do that. And that's really, really hard, everybody. And one of the reasons I've been able to do that is physical fitness has always been my number one investment. And because to be able to break away from the herd, you have to be mentally strong. Really mentally strong. And the only way you're going to be mentally strong is to be physically strong to do that. That's the easiest way. And so you just have to develop that and just say, you know, that I'm able to do that. I have the strength of my convictions to do that. You know, when it's time to get away from the market, I don't need everybody's approval, you know, confirmation basis to do whatever I'm doing. Because that's probably one of the worst emotional biases you can have. But you need to be mentally strong to go, this is the right move to make. The probability says this is the right move to make. Is it a hard decision to sell when everybody at the peak of the market? Very hard. It's just as hard to buy at the bottom of the market because fear is running rampant. So the two emotions are fear and greed, and that's what rules the market. And very rarely are they at equilibrium. Only one of them is ruling. Like in the last 10 years, greed has ruled the real estate market. Buy, 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 buy. And when we get into this downturn that is starting right now, it's going to be fear, 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 fear. And so you got to know, you just have to use some metrics. Like in my book, I identify five different indicators that are leading indicators, the major trend changes in housing markets, that follow those indicators and then be mentally strong enough to withstand herd pressure and do the opposite. That's the way you get ahead in life, guys.
On fitness, how important is it to maintain muscle when you're older?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. I think I mentioned I'm 75 years old. I just hired a new trainer. And to keep muscle on, guys, you got to keep muscle on your body. And the only way to keep muscle on your body is you got to lift weights. And most of the time you got to keep, I mean, I'm not talking about little dinky weights. You don't have to, it's not like a muscle builder, but you got to lift weights. To keep your muscles strong, your shoulder muscles strong, your leg muscles strong, because that's what keeps you healthy, and that's what keeps you young. That's what keeps your attitude young. You know you're in good shape, you feel good. You just feel good, you're physically strong. But the muscle, I have friends my age, and you know, and they go, they may not be fat, you know, they may not be overweight, but if they don't lift weights, they're just doing yoga or something, they're scrawny. They're scrawny. So what you want to be is you want to get older and maintain that muscle in your shoulders, in your chest, in your legs, in your back. Because who has muscle? Old people or young people? Young people. You want to look old or young? Everybody wants to look younger. So just, it's imperative that guys keep muscle on their body. And that's the discipline, guys, that you got to work every day every single day to do something to make sure that muscle stays on your body and to keep the fat off your gut.
Any other fitness wisdom for us?
Oh, that's pretty much encapsulates it, you know, this time, Jim. I could go on and on. All you guys out there that have heard me before, you know how much I'm into physical fitness. Both my parents were into physical fitness. So this has been the most important part of my life for my entire life. I'm going to write a report in about a 30-page report that what I've learned about physical fitness and health in the last 50 years. Because all my followers know. They know I always talk to them about that. They know I'm in great shape. They know I have a lot of energy. They all wonder how I do it. You know, what fitness tips could you give me, Bob? I go, there's way more than one. So I'm going to write a 30-page report, and I'm going to charge $295 for it, not because I need the money, but to keep the riffraff down. And I was telling a friend of mine, I said, you know what? I don't care. I'm going to write that report whether I sell one copy or even if I don't sell any copies. And he looked at me, because most of my stuff, it's for men like over 60, over 55. He goes, Bob, oh, you're going to sell a lot of those things. Because if you walk the walk, guys, you can talk the talk, you know? And I'm not afraid to tell you, I'm in great, great physical shape. I'm strong. I'm a strong 75-year-old guy. I train with a 21-year-old kid. And he goes, Mr. Campbell, he goes, you're strong. And I go, I know I am. I said, I lift heavy weights. He goes, I can tell. Because we just started out like a couple months ago, and he gave me these light weights. I said, we need to have more weight. And he watches me, and he goes, you're strong. So you have to have strong muscles. And when you have strong muscles, then that gives you the ability to be mentally strong, that you can handle whatever life dishes out. Because you got the physical strength, now you need the mental strength, you know, to like never give up. Don't get discouraged about anything. And I read something. Here's something for you guys. Like, whatever you do, if you're doing it at a high level, let's say you're practicing for a pro sport, high school football, and you're going through the drills, right? Those are hard. On a hot day, and I heard what this one coach said, people go, I've had it. I can't do this anymore. And what the coach tells them, he says this, you can't quit today. If you want to quit, quit tomorrow. So my trainer's pushing me to the point for an hour, and finally, you know, one day I said, I can't do any more of these ball crushes. They're really hard things to do. And I said, I can't do any more. I'm exhausted. He said, you're going to finish. And I said, I finished, and I thought about that. I said, yeah. I said, I'm glad you made me do this. I said, because if you don't improve, you know, my physical condition and help me lose 5 pounds in the next 2 months of body fat, I'm firing you and hiring somebody else. And he goes, I know that. That's why I'm making you do this stuff. So, I mean, you can't quit, guys. It has to be that kind of attitude. And that's totally a mental thing. That's nothing physical about it. Mental. Your body, I could do another set of 15 ball, you know, medicine ball crushes where you throw them into the ground as high as you can, a 15-pound medicine ball, and you have to catch it when it bounces up in the air and bring it up in your head. Those are exhausting. But the fact, could I do that physically? Of course I could, because I did it. Why didn't I want to do it? Because mentally I thought I wasn't tough enough. And I was tough enough. So that's where the mental aspect comes in. You just don't give up. You just can't, and you have somebody push you like that. Now, you can't have somebody push you like that every day, or you'd be a physical wreck at my age. But once a week, wow, what a magnificent, you know, thing to do to your body. So I'm spending practically all my retirement money on my health. And he said, so you start to look at it, trainers aren't cheap. They're like $100 an hour. I've got the money. And so I said, what else would I rather spend $100 a training session on? Working out with this kid that's going to kick my ass and get my body into optimal physical and mental condition? Or would I rather go out and have lunch with some friends and have a couple drinks? I'll hire the trainer. And so, yeah, in fact, I even told him, I said, I'm even hiring him for my wife. I'm so impressed with it. My wife's going to go in. She works out like a maniac like I do, too, or we wouldn't be together. So I'm paying for her. So that's how I'm going to spend all my money. I'm not going on sea cruises. I'm at the friggin' gym doing medicine ball crushes. People look at me and go, those look hard. And they go, they are hard. So anyway, take care of your body, guys. You got to do it. You know what? And I may have said this before, but I'll say it again. Confucius. A rich man wants 100 things. A man in poor health, only one. Only one. And so you just got to keep that in mind. There's not a day that I wake up in the morning that my activity, the first thought on my mind is what I'm going to do to stay physically and mentally fit. That's it. It's not like, boy, maybe I'm going to work 10 hours a day here and make more money. No, it's physical fitness. I'm going to go run. I'm going to do sprints. I'm going to go to the gym, lift weights. I'm going to work out with my trainer. That is numero uno, guys. Number one. Nothing comes between me and taking care of my body. Nothing. I mean, like, it just doesn't happen. So, and that's how you get physically fit. That's how you have my kind of energy, my kind of enthusiasm. You can develop that. It's developable. Most guys my age, you know, aren't like this. They go, where'd you get your energy? Well, today I've had 3 cups of coffee. I do drink coffee, so that helps. Caffeine does help. But, you know, it's from taking that attitude. And so that's why even though I'm in the money business, showing people how to make money in real estate, and I love to make money in real estate too, nothing comes between me and taking care of my body.
Bob, how can people find out more about your book and newsletter?
They can go to my website, realestatetiming.com, realestatetiming.com, and they can, buy my book. They can subscribe to my newsletter. They can learn a little bit. They can even see a sample newsletter, a little bit more about what I do. And check it out. I think it's interestingly, most people don't pay for investment information. Rarely will anybody pay for investment information. I pay for investment information because I know those people that are really good at what they do, and I want to know what they know. That's what keeps me ahead of the crowd. Does anybody know more about real estate timing than me in the world? I don't think so. I mean, look, I've been around real estate my whole life. I was born on a building site. My dad was a builder. I was born with a skill saw in one hand and a hammer in the other. Skill saw, cut the board, and I'd lift the boards up together and bang them, put a nail in the board and nail it together. And so in fact, the best way to make money in real estate, guys, let me tell you the best way to make money in real estate, is to buy a fixer-upper at the bottom of the market when prices are depressed. Move into it, fix it up with your own skills. I can do 90% of the work myself, and you don't have, and I wasn't naturally born with those skills. Just Google it. You can find out how to do anything. As long as you're not like just a complete spaz and gonna cut your arm off with a skill saw, then you might have to hire somebody or help you somebody with that. But fix your house up for the upcycle, sell the house, 5 or 6 years later when prices are high. The first $500,000, at least here in the United States, is tax-free, guys. Tax-free money. $500,000. Now, I know that's not a fortune, but that will put you on the road to financial, you know, to be financially strong. One of my followers that has followed me for 15 years, she bought a home in this high-end area. She sold it at the peak of the market in 2005 for $850,000. She bought it back 4 years later, based on my timing signals, for $500,000. She saved $350,000. She owned that home for the next 10 years. She just sold it about a year ago for $1.5 million, moved east away from the beach, poor thing, and bought a house out in the sticks, a fixer-upper for $600,000, and she owns it free and clear, and they have $1 million in the bank. Now, okay, she's got a house free and clear and $1 million in the bank. Does she classify as super wealthy? No. Is she way wealthier than your average bear? Yeah, way wealthier. So you can do this, guys. I love stories like that. People that actually take action to do something, to buy low and sell high. That's the only way you're going to really get ahead in life. That's the golden rule of investing. Buy low, sell high. That's what my dad told me. I started investing in stocks when I was in high school. I said, Dad, how do you make money in stocks? He said, you buy low and sell high. I said, how do you do that, Dad? And he said, that's what everybody wants to know. And it's been a curiosity for me from that day forward to the present day. And it's still an ultimate fascination, you know, how I've increased my skills as far as what I do. In fact, I'm even going to write another book. I wrote my first book 21 years ago. I've at least doubled or tripled my knowledge. I need to write another book on this. I've learned so much more about timing than I ever knew 21 years ago, even though it's still excellent material. I still use it to this day. But do I know more now? Yeah, I know a lot more now. So the education process never ends, guys. And that's, and you know, to me, retiring is something you should never do. If you love what you do, don't retire. Don't. What are you going to do? Babysit the grandkids? I mean, how boring than that? Is that? What am I going to do if I retire? Go to the beach? After 2 weeks, every day? After 2 weeks, I'd be totally bored out of my mind. So you got to keep your mind engaged, doing something that has value to other people, something that you love. And you know what? You can live the most magnificent life, and if you take care of your health and your body, you'll only live a magnificent life.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim. Bye.
My guest has been Robert Campbell, publisher of the RealEstateTiming.com newsletter. He was speaking to us from San Diego. Coming up, Ray Merriman, next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico, Battery Materials Incorporated, trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Ray Merriman, founder of Merriman Market Analyst and the author of several books on the correlation between market cycles and planetary cycles. His website, mmacycles.com. He's speaking to us from Scottsdale, Arizona. Ray, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jim. It's good to be back with you.
The Merriman Market Analyst is now into its 40th year. Can you tell us a bit about your letter and how people can sign up for it?
Yes. Well, you know, on Twitter, they now refer to me as a bona fide OG, an original gangsta, because I've been around for so long. So, yeah, I started the letter in 1982. That's a monthly report. It now has morphed into, we have weekly reports and daily reports for daily traders. And all of our reports involve market timing using cycles, geocosmic studies, within the context of trend analysis. We try to stay with the trend at the, what is known as the primary cycle level. And I also use chart pattern recognition studies because cycles behave in certain patterns. Techno analysis, because when we get to a time band when a cycle bottom or a top is due, we want to see an oversold condition on our oscillators. And we also use price objective calculations. They're specific, the ones we use. And if we get into those price target zones in the time band, we're looking for a reversal. Then we're going to issue a buy or sell signal. And the major markets that we're tracking, Jim, are stock indices, gold, silver, currencies, treasury, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and crude oil. When I say stock indices, I mean the Dow, the NASDAQ, the S&P. Then we also cover the DAX and the SMI in Switzerland and Germany. We cover the Shanghai Composite in China. We cover the Nikkei in Japan. So that's a summary of what we do.
How are things at the Merriman Market Analysis Academy?
Well, it's actually the Merriman Market Timing Academy, MMTA. We just finished our second 2-year program with 45 students who spent 2 years with us. That's actually 24 weekends, every Saturday, for 24 weeks a year over a 2-year period. They also have to do research studies. They have to pass tests. They have to pass the final exam. And 16 of them completed all the research studies, all the exams, and all the requirements we have for graduation. So we have an excellent group of new market timers coming onto the scene from all over the world. They're from France, Germany, UK, Australia, India, Spain, Switzerland, of course, the United States and Canada. So I'm really proud of them. Our third 2-year program of MMTA is scheduled to start March 18, 2023. And we'll be announcing that just as soon as our forecast writing for this year is over, which will be early December. You know, every year I write the annual forecast book. So once again, the MMTA, the Academy, will be limited to 45 students for the 2-year program. It will probably be the last two-year MMTA courses that I will be personally involved in monitoring. I'm going to be turning that over to our MMTA director, Gianni DiCoci, who will offer the program after that with other top graduates. So this will be the last two-year program that I'm probably going to be, you know, involved in every single week. And I'm really looking forward to it, because it's an exciting experience for me as it is for the students. So thank you for asking.
Can financial astrology see what's ahead for inflation and interest rates? And should we call it financial astrology or something else?
You can call it financial astrology or geocosmic studies. I mean, actually what we're doing is market timing, and astrology is one of the tools that help in market timing, along with cycles and GAN. I don't use GAN, but I respect GAN and his work. But we do use astrology, which I think is the most, certainly the most amazing and precise and consistently accurate tool for picking reversals in the market. But those reversals don't mean a lot if you don't understand where you are in the cycle. You know, if you're having the astrology that geocosmic studies say we're getting reversal and you're in the middle of a cycle, it's not as important as when you're at the end of a cycle. That's much bigger. So astrology doesn't differentiate that, just as you're going to get turning points at these points, but you just need to know where you are in the cycle. So as far as the correlation to inflation and interest rates, the correlations in those fields are a bit sketchy and wide, but I think we may see greater control over interest rates and inflation, less surprises, to start taking effect sometime between March and July of 2023. And that is based on geocosmic. It's based on the Jupiter-Saturn cycle. I also think we're going to see a more deflationary environment start to appear sometime by the end of 2023 and into 2026. And that's based on Saturn entering the sign of Pisces on March 7, 2023, and headed toward Neptune in February 2026. Saturn's tendency is to depress, and Neptune and Jupiter's tendency is to inflate. So when you get Saturn coming in the picture with Neptune, I think it's going to put a real lid on inflation. And we're going to start seeing more things like people struggling. I think I see more unemployment. I think I see more companies struggling to make profit, more government intervention. And I think these things are all going to be deflationary, or at least non-inflationary. And I don't see that starting this year, because Jupiter is going to go back into Pisces October to December, late October to late December. So I do not think inflation is under control this year. I think it's not until after some pretty March and July it starts to contract. And everybody's going to think it's under control, but I think what you're going to see is, once again, the Fed overshoots the opposite way again, and it's going to turn more into deflation.
Can financial astrology predict if the stock market will continue to be in a bear market or if a new bull market is beginning?
No, astrology can't predict that, but cycles and trend analysis studies can and do. Actually, there is an astrological correlate to this. When Jupiter leaves Aries, which it will do next May, when Jupiter leaves Aries and goes toward Leo, those 2 to 3 years do have a strong correlation of stock indices falling. So I shouldn't say that astrology can't predict it. There is a study, the Jupiter study, that does indicate that the stock market will have, it may have already started, because we're in Aries and we've made a high. We're going to get a secondary high. But after that secondary high, we may see the bear market resume, and it could last for 2 to 3 years. So what astrology does is accurately predict periods of time. It's a timing mechanism. Like last week, September 21st to October 3rd, that was the strongest geocosmic, time band of geocosmic, signatures unfolding in a short amount of time this year. But it's hard to say if those are reversals of long, intermediate, or short-term trends unless you understand the pattern, time bands, and cycles in combination with trends. So I don't think astrology is a great tool for predicting a bear and bull market. It's useful. It has some correlation. But cycles is better. And it's patterns that go with cycles. That's better for knowing when a long-term cycle bottom or top is due, where astrology is just going to tell you the turning point all the way through it. And whether they're short-term, intermediate-term, or long-term, astrology doesn't really care that much. There are some studies, but there's not enough to say that it can predict a bull or bear market. Other, maybe that's Jupiter. That's a pretty impressive study. It has about an 80% correlation that says the market could be falling from a secondary high sometime in, you know, soon until 2025, 2026.
And just about your technique of using geocosmic cycles, you're more concerned about the planets because they're close enough to actually have gravitational influence on us, right?
Well, to me, that's not what I look at.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I mean, if I'm trying to be inductive and try to figure out why these things happen, that would be my explanation. There is some kind of a gravitational effect. But I'm more deductive in my analysis. I go back and look, you know, at the charts of the stock market since the late 1600s, and I examine the daily charts of the Dow since 1928. That's what, almost 100 years. And I correlate it, like, you know, all those highs that move 4%, 10%, 20%, what was going on astrologically? What was going on with geocosmic? And is there anything that correlates, any of those studies that correlate with those kinds of moves? And there are. And when those happen, when I get those 4%, 10%, 20% time bands suggested by geocosmic studies, then, depending what type of cycle I'm in, I feel confident to make a forecast that this is the end of the primary cycle or the 26-month cycle or the 4-year cycle or the 18-year cycle. But I need to have my time bands for cycles in place. And on top of that is where I then use the astrology. But whether the astrology has an effect because of gravitational pull, I can't say for sure. Science hasn't really proven that. It makes sense. It's logical. But I can show you that there are correlations, and those correlations give me probabilities to work with.
Are some sectors of the stock market looking better than others?
Yeah. For instance, Jupiter going back into Pisces, I mean, that looks good for energy again. Crude oil. I also think, and other financial astrologers or market timers using astrology may differ from me on what I'm going to say next. But I think Saturn going into Pisces, March of 2023 through early 2026, and Pisces ruling the healthcare sector, and Saturn being depression, I think that's going to be good for the healthcare sector. I think first of all, I think Saturn and Pisces indicates that there's a continuation of a health crisis. You know, I don't think we're fully over the COVID or the pandemic. I don't think we're safe yet. I don't think our immune systems have recovered as a global community. I think we're still under the weather, if you will. And I think we're going to continue under the weather for another 3 years. And that means that people are going to become increasingly concerned about their health, about health care, about their diet, about their nutrition, and even about their medicine. So I kind of think those companies that deal in these areas of healthcare are going to do extremely well because of the great demand. The one thing that concerns me, though, is that Saturn is also government intervention. And so maybe there is more demand for more products and greater sales, but the government may put on price controls, and that can severely limit or thwart the profitability of these companies. That's the biggest impediment that I see to profitability and gains in the healthcare field or even pharmaceutical field is government intervention. It's not that I'm opposed to it with the high prices of pharmaceuticals, but you know, if you ask me where the demand is going to be in the next couple of years, it's going to be in energy and it's going to be in healthcare. That's how I see it.
Does astrology see any surprises in store for the financial markets this month?
Well, not as big as we went through between January and September. I don't think it's as big as that. But the last 10 days of this month of October do look dicey for many markets like stocks. I mean, that's when we're going to have planets changing signs. We're leaving the sign of Libra with the Sun, Mercury, Venus. We're going to go into Scorpio. Mars is going to turn retrograde. Saturn is going to turn retrograde. So we've come out of a period, Jim, from September 10th to October 2nd, where six planets are what we say were in retrograde direction. That means as you look at them in the Earth, you're going backwards through the sky, not forward. That's a lot when you only consider there's 8 planets, you know, not counting the Earth. And 6 of them, of those 8, were retrograde. That doesn't happen very often. I mean, yeah, it happened last year, the year before, but before that, it didn't happen for a few years. So it's unusual to see 6 or more, even 5 or more planets is unusual. More like, I mean, the more normal is, you know, 2 to 4 planets are retrograde at any one time. So we've had 6 retrograde planets from September 10th to October 2nd. The market was almost straight down all that time. And as soon as that ended, the market started going up. And now when Mars goes retrograde October 30th, within a week of that, we're going to have 5. So we're going to, again, have this uncertainty feeling, this uncomfortable feeling that things aren't stable. And that's why I say the last 10 days of October, even into November, could be dicey as we start moving toward 5 planets retrograde, including Mars. I don't think it's an October surprise. The surprise is what we went through September 2nd to September 30th. We had the September surprise.
Is astrology any good at predicting election outcomes like next month's U.S. midterms?
You mean, are we better than the polls? The polls aren't too good. I think astrology is fairly good at this. I think it's, you know, in the neighborhood of 75% to 80%. You may not like this, or some of your listeners, or our listeners may not like it, but I think, as I look at it, it points to less losses, maybe even gains for the Democrats than most pundits expect. And I think that's because the Dems will succeed in making Donald Trump a major campaign issue. And he'll take the bait. He is taking the bait. And I think that causes losses for the Republicans who otherwise would normally win. Because the Democrats, now I'm giving you an opinion here, bias, the Democrats cannot win on their record or their vision, which is out of step with Jupiter and Saturn waxing, which means they're separating, through the end of this decade. And that indicates what is needed to succeed politically and to be supported by the public politically is a policy of moderation and balanced financial oversight. And unfortunately, I do not see the Democrats of the executive branch, the Senate or the House of Representatives, acting as if they have any kind of a clue on how to handle the nation's treasury, as evidenced by their blowout spending, which has contributed mightily to the inflation surge. And instead of increasing production of goods to counteract the supply chain disruptions, they instead were focused on increasing consumer demand, which is exactly the opposite of what is needed to bring down inflation. Again, this is an opinion, but I think it's an opinion shared by many people who study economics and things like inflation. So the result, as I see it, the astrology, is that this behavior of the leadership we have now is bringing us ever closer to a debt crisis. Unfortunately, though, that's on the minds of many people, but I don't know that that's going to counteract the Trump effect, which is going to drive people away from people that Trump has supported. And I think that cost Republican seats because he, of course, is supporting many Republicans, which is, I think there's a good number of Republicans who could be of service to this country. But if they're associated with Trump, I hate to say it, but it's not a winning combination for them, I don't think, in this election cycle.
What are the planets predicting for gold?
Well, the planets aren't predicting one way or the other, but the cycles in some key fundamental reports suggest that gold may be in the beginning stages of a sharp 2 to 5 month rally back to 1875 to 1950, maybe even 2000. But I don't think gold is going to get to new highs. I still believe the lows of the 7.83 and 23.5 year cycles are pointed down into 2023 and 2025, and the gold will still reach $1,200, give or take $200 at that time. Then it looks good. Now, there is a couple periods that actually are favorable for gold based on astrology in 2023. I don't have them right at my fingertips, but sometime there is something in the toward the end of 2023 that, you know, the last quarter, about a year from now, if gold can get down to that price range at that point, then I think it becomes an excellent investment for the next 2040, give or take a couple years. So that would be 15, 20 years. I think that gold could do very, very well. So I think this is a great buying opportunity coming up with this low in 2023, 25, and it might be as early as late 2023.
What are you seeing ahead for currencies, the U.S. dollar, and Bitcoin?
Well, the presidential election cycle says the dollar rally can continue into January 2025, give or take 6 months. That's still another 2 years to go. Yeah, there'll be a pullback in there, probably pretty strong pullback, but it's not going to be a bear market unless you're looking at, you know, a 1 year cycle or 2 year cycle being bearish. But I think the 4 year and the 8 year cycles are still pointed higher until we get to the election, give or take 6 months. Actually, the inauguration, give or take 6 months. So I think the dollar is still in a bull market, even if we do have a strong correction. It's still in a bull market for another almost 2 years. Bitcoin cycle, now this is interesting. Bitcoin cycle points to a low between March by March of 2023. And that time band could have started as early as June, and we did have a low in June. I think that's too early, but it is in the first month possible for a 4 year cycle or a 15 month cycle. They both overlap at that point. So if the low isn't already in, I think it will be in by March of 2023, maybe even by January. My feeling is that unless Bitcoin starts getting above 22,000, I think it could drop again below 17,000, maybe to 15,000. I'd like it there. Maybe even 8,000 to 12,000. However, I want to say that I think the future of digital currencies is bright. The thing is, I believe that we're moving into a cycle, a major, very long-term, like 250-year cycle, maybe even a 500-year cycle, where currencies, the way we approach currencies is going through a radical change. I think we're going through the biggest changes in currency markets in at least 250 years, maybe 500 years. And I think what that means is governments are going to legalize and create their own digital currencies. We're going to get away from paper. We're going to go to digital. I think that's the future for the next 20 years. So I'm not sure what effect that's going to have on Bitcoin, if they're going to, you know, utilize Bitcoin or make it illegal. But the concept of digital currencies, I think, is the future. I'm pretty convinced of that now, where I wasn't 6 months ago. Now I am.
If they do put in digital currency across the planet, will people still try to get around that government system and invent their own kind of currency, a people's currency?
That's a really good question. You know, I'm basing this on Pluto going into Aquarius. Pluto is debt, which means it's also currency. Currency is basically a form of debt. It's credit and debt, but the saving of it is credit, but the spending of it is debt. And Pluto going into Aquarius indicates a revolution in debt. So will people still try to get around government? Yeah, I think there's going to be an effort to do it, whether they succeed or not. That's a good question. You know, I mean, Aquarius is the people. You know, Capricorn, which we're coming out of, is the government. We're leaving the government and moving more toward power to the people. We're moving away from central governments, more toward communal governments, if you will. And so that could support the idea of people trying to still establish their own forms of currencies without banks or central banks, without government. Whether they succeed or not, have to think about that more. I don't know.
Is astrology predicting any potentially important upcoming events?
Well, again, I hate to say this too, but I think the possibility of a nuclear attack and strike by Putin is very real. I also think he will lose this war, and he'll be out of power within the next 3 years, maybe sooner. And this is related to the Saturn-Neptune 36-year cycle. Now, every 36 years, Saturn and Neptune come together. They were there in 2026. They're going to be there in 2026. They were there in 1989. And, you know, that's when the Soviet Empire collapsed. The Soviet Union collapsed and became just Russia, no more communist Russia at that point. Before that, it happened in 1952 and 53, and that's when Joseph Stalin died, and he was his reign went from 1924 to what, 1953? So that was a huge change of the government. We entered the Cold War then. Before that, it was 1917, and that was when Lenin and the Bolsheviks took over the government, and the Tsar ceased to exist. Before that, it was, I think, Tsar Alexander in early 1880s was assassinated. So you go back every 36 years, there is an implosion or explosion of Russian government. Now, what makes this extremely interesting now is not only did Stalin die in 1953, which is two of those cycles ago, but Vladimir Putin was born then. And the biggest event in his life that shaped what his legacy is going to be is what happened with the next Saturn Neptune, 1989, when Gorbachev released the Russian communist countries to enter the free market. And that was a huge influence on who Vladimir Putin became and would become and is, in fact, now. That is the venom, the hatred, if you will, the resentment that he had toward Gorbachev and the West over that event was the biggest event in his life, which shaped who he is and what his legacy is. And the third time it's going to pass is going to be 2026. So within a year or two of that, it's going to be another huge event in his life and Russia's unfolding history. So the other thing you might want to note is that Saturn and Neptune by themselves have many themes. And one of the themes of Saturn and Neptune is paranoia. We are in, and it's going to increase a very paranoid time. When you get world leaders who are paranoid and have created a whole system of organization in their mind based upon their interpretation of events and the resentment of those events, it locks them into a certain personality order or disorder. And you can't dislodge that. And what's interesting is, to me, he's born with that. And not everybody born with that is going to manifest that way. But he's born with that. And the biggest event in his life which changed his destiny occurred when that happened. And the next time it happens is going to change his destiny too, I believe. But the other thing that's interesting is Xi Jinping was also born at that time. So if you get two people who have what you would call a paranoid signature, and one of them, if not both, but if one of them exhibits an extreme of that paranoid behavior, which is based on mistrust, you wonder how long they're going to stay together, how long they're going to support one another. Something's going to come up here in the next 3 years where I think, you know, unless they're both paranoid, I think there's going to be a split between those two leaders. And I think when that happens, the world may become safer. Some people think that if either one of them lose their power, the world become more dangerous. I only half believe that. But this is something I share with you and our listeners, what I'm looking at astrologically and what will be one of the themes of the forecast book coming out. And that's my view on it.
What are the strongest looking markets according to financial astrology for the rest of the year?
I think crude oil. I think crude oil is the strongest for the rest of the year. Maybe gold too. But I don't think gold is going to last more than two to five months. Whereas crude oil, I think it's going to continue going up. You know, generally speaking, it's going to be in a bull market until we get to 2026. So, even though I may not believe in the future of fossil fuels, and I believe more in the future of alternative fuels, transforming our reliance upon energy sources, I think that's still a good three years away before you start seeing that transition. And somewhere around that point, 3 to 5 years from now, I think is maybe when crude oil tops off. But for the next 3 to 5 years, I think it looks good. You look beyond that, and I think artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, which is already picking up steam again. But I think if you can have a 3 to 7 year horizon, I think artificial intelligence and electric vehicles have a very bright future ahead.
Ray, again, how can people find out more about Merriman Market Analyst?
Well, they can go to MMACycles.com. That's www.MMACycles.com. That's our website. We have free weekly reports that we post there every Friday night. If you want to be on a distribution list and have those reports sent to you, you can, you know, give us your email address at that site, and we'll make sure you get on our list to receive that as soon as they're written every Friday evening.
Ray, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
You're welcome, Jim. Pleasure to be with you.
My guest has been Ray Merriman, publisher of Merriman Market Analyst on MMACycles.com. He was speaking to us from Scottsdale, Arizona. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Robert Campbell, and Ray Merriman. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.